Good morning.
As announced on Wednesday, if you were here, I was going to teach. I'm going to teach on J. Gresham Machen, but there's really two stories here. It's not just a story of Machen. It's a story of the leaven of the Sadducees, Matthew 16:6. What happens if that leaven gets inside of a theological institution? How liberalism can take apart a seminary. And we have this going on in our day, and so much of what Machen wrote in his day is relevant for our day. But to begin, what was Princeton Theological Seminary in its heyday? Princeton Theological Seminary, prior to 1929, was regarded by many pastors and theologians as a citadel of historic Christianity. The original professors were Ashbel Green, Archibald Alexander, and Charles Hodge. I'm going to do a little overview of Princeton Seminary because, you know, there's new people coming to the Reformed faith all the time, and maybe you don't know anything about this seminary. It was started in 1812. Really, it had its roots way back in the theological training at the Law College, which was started by William Tennant in the 1740s. Continued on through the College of New Jersey, but the Presbyterian Church itself never had a seminary in the United States to prepare men until it was devised in 1811. The two founders of Princeton were Archibald Alexander and Ashbel Green. Ashbel Green was a son of a godly and a pious father. Both of them were acquaintances of George Washington, that kind of shows you what time period that was. Ashbel Green was the editor of a book called The Christian Advocate. This is one of the prizes in my library. I have 11 of the 12 volumes. This predates what was called the Biblical Repertory or Princeton Review. And one of the reasons why this is prized is Ashbel Green's signature is right here. And he was a personal friend of George Washington. So that book, you know, is kind of hard to replace. This was the actual Princeton Review, a copy of the theological magazine put out by Princeton from 1832 until they reorganized basically in 1929. Now, when Princeton began, the theological teacher was Ashbel Green. He was the only teacher. He taught all of the classes in 1812. You can imagine his workload. By 1813, he saw the burden of it, and the second professor was Samuel Miller, who was brought on in 1813 to help in the training at Princeton Seminary. The two families that you really want to keep in mind at the beginning of the history of Princeton are the Hodges and the Alexanders. Charles Hodge on the left was actually called as the third professor at Princeton when he was only 22 years old. So for over 50 years, he's the guy that's teaching systematic theology at Princeton Seminary. We know him mostly for his magnum opus, a three-volume systematic theology by Charles Hodge, published in 1871. But he actually was brought on at Princeton to teach Old Testament studies, and it was with great reluctance that he went from that into teaching systematic theology. But we're very thankful he did. A.A. Hodge was his son, named after Archibald Alexander, and Caspar Wistar Hodge actually died about the same year as Machen. I just discovered this week, as much as I've studied the history of Princeton, that there were two men by the same name. Archibald Alexander Hodge had a brother named Caspar Hodge, and his son was Caspar Hodge. That's why I couldn't keep the dates straight, because one date said he died in 1881 and another in 1937. That's because there were two of them. J.A. Alexander was Archibald Alexander's son. He taught New Testament. I've introduced him before because J.A. Alexander and J.W. Alexander were brothers when both of them died. One was in the Fifth Presbyterian Church in New York and one was at Princeton. Their survivors both tried to plug in Robert Dabney to get them to come to their place to succeed them. One is a preacher, the other to teach at Princeton. Neither of them were successful. But I'd mentioned, to give you an idea of what kind of minds these men had, J.A. Alexander here knew 26 languages. You think that's impressive? Robert Dick Wilson, one of the later ones who followed J. Machen out when they formed Westminster Seminary, was said to know 45. This is Benjamin Warfield, one of the greatest minds of the last century. Gerhardus Voss actually began his teaching here in Grand Rapids, and of course, Machen. And so it is a rich history. Personally, I'm more indebted to the first generation of the Princeton theologians. I have my predilection that way because I think that they came more out of the Puritan tradition. But I think even more importantly was the fact that the original three men were all pastors during the Second Great Awakening. And so their pastoral writings are very experimental and very helpful that way. And I'm going to talk more about that as I go on, because I thought as I studied this in the history of Princeton, as the seminary kept going on, it seemed like the pastorate and the theologian were being more and more separated, and I see problems that that caused in the history of the church. But anyway, Machen was born on July 28, 1881 in Baltimore to Arthur Webster Machen and Mary Jones Gresham. That's Gresham, the H is silent. Arthur, a Baltimore lawyer, was 45 and Mary was 24 when they married. His father was an Episcopalian, his mother was a Presbyterian, and they both attended Franklin Street Presbyterian Church. They were devout Christians and they were well off financially. And that plays into the picture because Machen was always well-to-do. He never really needed the money that was offered to him at Princeton. It was never an attraction to him. As I was listening to Piper on this, it said that his starting salary was $2,000 a year at Princeton. It was actually $1,000. And his first inheritance from his maternal grandfather was $50,000. He received a second inheritance from his father when he passed away. And so at the time of Machen's passing away, he had $250,000 in his estate, which showed that he was pretty well off, and this comes into play later on. But his parents were devout Christians, and they raised him on the Westminster Shorter Catechism, Pilgrim's Progress, and at the age 14, he professed faith in Christ and joined the Franklin Street Church. In 1898, the 17-year-old Machen began studying at Johns Hopkins University, that's in Baltimore, for his undergraduate degree and did well enough to gain a scholarship. Despite having some indecisiveness about his future, he opted to study theology at Princeton Seminary, while at the same time studying a Master of Arts in Philosophy at Princeton University. He also pursued theological studies in Germany for a year in 1905. And that's an interesting thing to think about because Hodge had also gone to Germany. It was an interesting question. Why were some of these theologians continuing their training in Germany where so much higher criticism was going on? Hodge had studied under Schleiermacher. And Machen himself studied under a man named Wilhelm Hermann. To give you an idea who this guy is, he had already trained Karl Barth and Rudolf Bultmann. And so he was a complete theological liberal. To sum up what they were teaching, they maintained the experimental aspect of Christianity, of a present Christ, but they rejected the historicity of it. But what was so striking is somehow Hermann really had an impression on this young Machen. Somehow it seemed like he had this devotion to Christ, and Machen was really caught up by it. He was really taken away by it. His feet had almost slipped. Machen never married, so what we know from him was a lot of it is from the correspondence between him and his mother. Some between him and his father, but there's a number of letters between him and his mother that are in some detail during those days, and Machen was really taken in by this Hermann. And so, you know, I was reflecting on these things, and I know I'm not alone in some of the things that came to my mind, because I couldn't find my biography of Machen, so I borrowed Pastor Martin's. And his notes are in here from the year 1976, so I can read in the margins. And it's very interesting because I said to myself, he's thinking what I'm thinking, and that is, what was wrong with the teaching at Princeton Seminary when you had men like Gerhardus Voss And Benjamin Warfield, this Machen who's already sat a year under these people's ministry, goes to Germany and almost becomes a liberal. What was it about the German theologians and their experimental Christianity that Machen saw that wasn't at Princeton? It just leaves a red flag there. I mean, you know, in those days, Billy Sunday was preaching, and in fact, it was interesting to hear about Machen's thoughts about Billy Sunday's preaching. He actually came to the seminary and preached, but Billy Sunday used to say, if you could take hell and turn it upside down, it would be stamp made in Germany. That's what they thought of the German higher criticism in those days. But anyway, at the same time that Machen is in Germany, he had already a reputation for his scholarly abilities back at Princeton. And so William Armstrong is writing to him, trying to get him back to Princeton to teach. And I'll show you where that's kind of questionable later on. But in 1906, Machen did join Princeton Seminary after a lot of persuasion. He really did not want to come at first. As an instructor in New Testament, after assurances, he would not have to sign a statement of faith. So he's coming back to Princeton Seminary. Presbyterian Church had already had a split in 1837, and Old Princeton were the strict subscriptionists who held to the Westminster Confession. They would not budge. But now, just a few years later, they're bringing this young Machen on, and he doesn't even have to subscribe to the statement of faith. That's how far that they had slipped. I learned a lot from a book that I found on Friday night, but because this book is 1,096 pages, I've just been able to peruse it a little. The book, ironically, is by Gary North. When Gary North is not espousing conspiratorial theories, he's really a helpful church historian. But this book is called Crossed Fingers, or How Liberalism Captured the Presbyterian Church, and it brings so much light to this time. Anyway, among Machen's influences were Francis Peyton, who had been the prosecutor in a 19th century heresy trial, that would have been Charles Briggs, and B.B. Warfield, whom he described as the greatest man he had ever met. Warfield maintains that correct doctrine was the primary means by which Christians influenced the surrounding culture, and he emphasized a high view of Scripture in the defense of supernaturalism. Machen, under their influence, finally resolved his questions about a call to the ministry. So here you got this picture of a man from 1906 to 1914, hasn't even been resolved in his mind that he's being called to the ministry, and he's already teaching at Princeton Theological Seminary. And that went against the standards of the old men. I mean, Archibald Alexander must have been turning in his grave. You got this man, he's not even ordained. He's teaching New Testament, and it takes him this long to decide what he wants to be when he grows up. But anyway, he made up for that later on. Machen did, World War I was going on at this time, and there's one thing that you have to understand about Machen. His family were personal friends of Woodrow Wilson. Wilson had actually spent time in the Machen home. However, Machen himself did not embrace Woodrow Wilson's idea of bringing democracy to the rest of the world. You know, some people compare him to what Bush was in the last war or whatever. For some reason, Machen appeared to be somewhat of a pacifist. I didn't study that out enough to have any comment on that, but he only served in World War I as a YMCA volunteer at or near the front, so he did witness a lot of the things that were going on in the war. But he did decide, after returning from Europe, to continue his work as a New Testament scholar at Princeton. During this period, he gained a reputation as one of the few true scholars who was able to debate the growing prevalence of modernist theology while maintaining an evangelical stance. So liberalism is starting to creep into the church. Into the seminary and the church. Machen was elected to the position of professor of apologetics at Princeton in 1926. He's elected to this position, but he actually was voted down because he had voted on the wrong side of the 18th Amendment or the Act of Prohibition, only because he thought that the federal government shouldn't be deciding this thing, the state should. But by this time, people were gunning for Machen. But
He strove to keep the seminary from going the way of the mainstream and fought within the denomination to bring about a conservative resurgence and return to the Reformed faith. So Machen continued to fight valiantly to save the seminary, but less than 3 years later, Princeton would undergo its infamous reconstruction. So that's kind of an overview. But let's talk a bit about the controversies that Machen was involved in. The year before, let's do a little background information. In 1902, the seminary was reorganized by the General Assembly. So you got this assembly of pastors or elders outside of the seminary who are actually calling the shots, and they wanted to have a strong presidency appointed by the General Assembly to give the church more effective control of the institution. In 1913, it appointed J. Ross Stevenson. So that was the old president, Francis Patton, when Machen got there. J. Ross Stevenson came in, and Stevenson's problem wasn't that he was against the Westminster Confession of Faith. There were a number of men at Princeton who didn't want to make any waves about the liberalism that was coming in. They didn't want to make a stir about it. They didn't want to push these people out. These people wouldn't step out on their own. But his problem was he was indifferent. The 50-cent word is latitudinarianism, and that's what marked some of these leaders. So it appointed Ross Stevenson, a moderate with strong affinities for church union, as president. The majority of the faculty opposed him. So you got the faculty of Princeton, they're opposing this new president, but they're not calling the shots. It's a General Assembly outside who's electing how these things are going to be run. In 1925, Stevenson requested that the board of directors of the seminary appoint a committee to investigate problems at the seminary. The General Assembly of 1926 was requested by a group of trustees and directors of Princeton to appoint a committee to investigate problems at the seminary, which it did. Earlier in that year, Dr. Machen had been appointed to the chair of apologetics and ethics at the seminary. The General Assembly postponed approving his election until the committee had done its work. The issue at stake was whether the seminary should continue its course of following Machen's position outlined in his book, Christianity or Liberalism, or whether the seminary should follow Stevenson's position and tolerate and represent the divergent viewpoints within the church. The year before Christianity and Liberalism came out, and this is a great book, even the opponents realized that the logic in this was unanswerable. They showed him a great deal of respect for that, and yet they wouldn't act on it. But the year before that book was put out, there was a Baptist pastor by the name of Harry Emerson Fosdick, a liberal, a modernist, who was called to be the associate pastor of New York's First Presbyterian Church in 1918. So here you got a Baptist pastor. He's elected to the eldership of a First Presbyterian Church. In light of the church's discussion on church union, Dr. Fosdick didn't transfer his membership to the PCUSA. In 1922, he preaches a ringing sermon entitled Shall the Fundamentalists Win, in which he defended liberalism and demanded toleration in the church for theological liberals and so on. So Machen has somebody that he has to lock horns with. Machen wrote his book, Christianity and Liberalism, taking the position that liberals were not Christians and that there were not two competing religions within the PCUSA. Liberals, of course, disagreed and claimed that there were merely two different expressions of Christianity in the church. The moderates held the balance of power, and they were committed to a peace and unity agenda that gave scant support to the conservative agenda of maintaining the purity of the church. In the meantime, the Presbyterian Church published what was called the Auburn Affirmation in May of 1924. This is the year after Machen's book, Christianity and Liberalism. And what you see up here is some of the things that stood for or against. What was interesting, the one thing they were not going to take a stand on, the one thing they were asking for toleration of, was the five fundamentals of the Christian faith: inerrancy of scriptures, a virgin birth, and the deity of Jesus, the doctrine of substitutionary atonement, the bodily resurrection of Jesus, and the authenticity of Christ's miracles. The affirmation challenged the authority of the General Assembly to make judicially binding decrees. It asserted that according to the Adopting Act of 1729, by which the American Presbyterian Church was created, no candidate for the Presbyterian ministry could be held to confess more than that the Westminster Confession contains a system of doctrine taught in the Holy Scriptures. Well, that's ironic. These people upheld the Westminster Confession, so they said. It was easy to make that kind of a statement. We uphold the Westminster Confession, but they never really took any stands on it, nor would they oppose anybody that was secretly against it. To single out any particular sections of the confession as essentials of the faith would not be legal without the confirmation of at least two-thirds of the presbyteries. In short, a man could swear allegiance to all of the confession, yet not be responsible for believing even one of its specifics. Of this document Machen wrote, another attack has been made by the modernist affirmation of 150 ministers, for which by an active propaganda many more signatures have now been secured. The affirmation does indeed employ Christian terminology, and deceived by this terminology, it's so important to get our words correct. You know, some people are so, in the emergent church, they're so flaky when it comes to defining where they stand. It's like if I poured some mercury on here and I'm trying to grab it, it's going to keep going all over the place. That's emergent theology. That's modernism. The affirmation does indeed employ Christian terminology, it says, but it was against the creedal character of the Presbyterian Church and against the entire factual basis of Christianity. Now, chronologically, the story of Pearl Buck doesn't come within this period, but we're dealing with Machen's controversies, so I need to talk about the liberalism that actually came into the mission field. This actually happened after the formation of Westminster Seminary in 1929. But this is how bad it had become in the missionaries and so on. They were more into kind of humanitarian aid and so on, and to relieve people's poverty and so on. So it was kind of a Mother Teresa-type Christianity, except I dare say that this lady was probably more liberal than Mother Teresa. As you can say, it says, if someone portrayed Christ in their life, what difference does it make if historically he lived? Whether he is the essence of men's highest dreams or whether he really did have a body and soul. This lady is married to a missionary who's in China. Later she divorced him and remarried. But there's a dilemma within the Presbyterian Church because it's going to be very difficult to oppose a lady who had won a Pulitzer Prize, was probably one of the most famous women in the world at that time. And so they had this dilemma on their hands. But there was a person who was the president of the General Assembly, I believe his name was Robert Speer, who also was the head of foreign missions. And he had written some books on the missionary field and what they stood for, and none of it was to propagate the truth of Christ. The Christian message had become old hat. They had something better. That was the old orthodoxy and so on. These people need something new. They don't need to hear that old message. And Machen knew when you were sharing the gospel with a heathen, you have to relieve the burden of their soul before you help their body. And so, once again, Machen clashed with them. So the next battlefield became the Board of Missions. William Ernest Hocking wrote a document for the Presbyterian Church along with other churches called Rethinking Missions, a layman's inquiry after 100 years. The article argued for cultural sharing rather than gospel sharing being the core for missions work. In his view, missionaries should be better trained in finance. They needed to cooperate with each other and even with non-Christian religions in their aid work. A PCUSA missionary to China by the name of Pearl Buck went on a speaking tour in the U.S. in favor of the report and raised publicity sky high for the Hawkins report. In Machen's view, Pearl Buck and other liberals were preaching apostasy from a PCUSA subsidized pulpit. And so another opponent of the gospel enters the councils of the church, and another false prophet goes forth to encourage sinners to come before the judgment seat of God clad in the miserable rags of their own righteousness. And he wasn't wrong in his assessment. Buck had been quite open in her views. "I do not believe in original sin," she said. And from Machen's perspective, it was much worse that she was adored and respected with an audience, at least for her fiction of millions. Buck was not some obscure missionary denying the virgin birth and preaching on equality of all faiths, but among Americans, the most well-known contemporary missionary of her time. Pearl Buck was a perfect example for Machen of how liberalism was not a variant of Christianity, but rather another faith. And thus she presented an excellent foil for Machen in demonstrating how the moderates, by not demanding strong adherence to the creeds, had allowed variants they never would have intended to become acceptable views within the church. Now, Pearl Buck actually resigned. They resigned as missionaries of the Presbyterian Church because they knew that they no longer upheld the standards of the Presbyterian Church. Interestingly, though, the Presbyterian Church turned against Machen. And Machen actually went to trial. This is about 1934. And, okay, so he's no longer a professor at Princeton Seminary. They're bringing him to trial, but on what technicality? Can you say that the guy's teaching false doctrine? The people trying him are the ones who are the liberals. So how are you going to get him? On this technicality that one of the things that you needed to say that you stood for as a pastor was helping the poor. And so they're going to tie in this Machen refused to give money to this liberal missionary group funding people like Pearl Buck. And he already had a great following. And so a number of people kind of sided with Machen. So they take Machen to this trial, which really is a kangaroo court. The whole thing is on false pretenses. Machen cannot even defend himself. When he's asked, what am I being brought to trial for? You know, basically they just shut him down and they removed him for insubordination. And so 16 people followed Machen. This is the Presbyterian Church of the USA which did this. And they followed Machen and formed another denomination called the Presbyterian Church of America. But within 6 months, the PCUSA sued them and said, you need to change your name because it's too much like our name. And that's how the Orthodox Presbyterian Church was formed. And they were started in 1934. So Machen is not only the founder of the Westminster Seminary, he's also the person who is most responsible for the forming of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. But anyway, back to Westminster Seminary. Eventually, Machen left Princeton on his own accord because in 1929 the seminary had reorganized and they just made it almost impossible for its purity to be maintained. And so Machen left Princeton and they had tossed around the idea of forming another seminary. There were four men who left with Machen. And one of them was Ned Stonehouse, who wrote his biography. The other was Oswald T. Alice. And Alice, like Machen, was pretty well-to-do and owned a kind of a decrepit place in Philadelphia where Westminster Seminary was started and gave him the unbelievable price of $1 a year. So financially, they were not at a burden at all. Machen was pretty well-to-do. And Oswald T. Alice was there, and Wilson. Wilson followed them over and so on. But the students to commence at Westminster never had to pay any kind of tuition. The 1929 General Assembly voted to reorganize Princeton Seminary and appointed two of the Auburn Affirmation's signatories as trustees. The Auburn Affirmation was a response by liberals within the Northern Presbyterian Church that condemned the General Assembly's response to the controversy arising out of Harry Emerson Fosdick's sermon. So that's why they were reorganized. Shall the fundamentalists win? In May 1922, Machen and some colleagues withdrew and set up Westminster Theological Seminary to continue old school theology. Is Pastor Sesema here today? I don't see Pastor. Okay.
The only reason I ask that is because Pastor Seesema helps me choose these biographical characters. And I was going to announce publicly that there's an obvious transition from the life of Machen. I'd like to teach on Cornelius Van Til next. But what's really interesting is how the theologians from Grand Rapids had such a part of the formation of Westminster Seminary. Voss never left Princeton, but Cornelius Van Til was actually pastoring in Spring Lake, Michigan, in 1926. I remember I was a mailman where Kriegel Bookstore was, and down the road was Bates Street, 650 Bates Street. There was First Christian Reformed Church, and I remember the history of that church was that they tried to call Cornelius Van Til in 1926, and he felt overwhelmed at the size of the church and took a small work at Spring Lake. It's interesting that that Christian Reform in Spring Lake was formed, because when they started that church, think about this, because some of you have been out there, you can picture it in your mind. You got Grand Haven on one side of the river and Spring Lake on the other. The church in Spring Lake was formed because before that, people would have to take a boat over from Spring Lake into Grand Haven, because they didn't have a drawbridge for sure in that day, so. But anyway, so Cornelius Van Til is intimately involved in this area, as well as R.B. Kuyper. And a lot of these men were pressed to come into Westminster Seminary to be a part of this seminary. And there's something that's kind of ironic about that, and that is that Van Til's apologetic method was really, really helpful after Old Princeton to combat this liberalism that was coming in, this presuppositional apologetics, because Van Til taught that there's no neutral ground. We're not going to find a common cause. This is war. We're dealing with people that are enmity against God. Van Til had actually written a book on Karl Barth, and you know, this guy had a great mind, and he was ruthless at taking apart liberal theology. I want to give you a chance for questions before I go on. I'm not real familiar with this history, but maybe I've raised some questions out here from anybody. Anyway, I want to talk for a minute on the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. In 1933, Machen became concerned about liberalism tolerated by Presbyterians on the mission field. We had talked about that, and formed an independent mission board. And that was what led to his trial. I want to read a section from Gary North on the trial for insubordination of Machen. Machen said nothing throughout the trial. Machen's defense counsel invoked the Auburn affirmation. Some members of the court had signed it, or were members of churches whose pastors had signed it. These men should not be sitting in judgment of Machen, his defense counsel argued repeatedly. Finally, court member Kaisinga appealed to the moderator. I think that this court is competent to decide that this is not a doctrinal controversy, nor a doctrinal question, and that no remarks of this sort shall be allowed in this court. He added that any reference to the Auburn affirmation was out of order, since the time for anyone to issue a challenge had run out under the statute of limitations. The unanimous final verdict of guilty was handed down on March 29th. All charges against him, Machen, were upheld. Machen has been guilty of conduct contrary to the government and discipline of the church, unfaithful in maintaining the peace of the church, has been insubordinate to the lawfully constituted authorities of the church, and has violated his ordination vows, has shown contempt of and rebellion against his superiors in the church, and has been guilty of a breach of his lawful promises. A breach of his lawful promises. He wasn't going to give to the poor because he wasn't going to support a liberal missionary in the field. The court took care to repeat the standard line, questions of doctrine have not entered into the case except as the defendant has endeavored to make them an excuse and justification for his willful disobedience of church authority and his disregard for his ordination vows. Machen was suspended as a minister of the Presbyterian Church in the USA, with execution of the sentence to be deferred until the case could be reviewed by the higher church courts. You know, I think about this history a lot because I've followed the history of the Presbyterian Church. how they had split in 1837, how faithful the men of Princeton had been, Charles Hodge and some of these people who were the strict subscriptionists. In 1837, there was a trial of Albert Barnes for heresy and Lyman Beecher and so on. Albert Barnes is the one that did the commentary that you're so well aware of. A lot of that commentary is really pretty good. His comments on Isaiah, his comments on Psalms, and his comments on Job, but his comment on Romans is deplorable. But the Presbyterian Church, the Princeton Seminary, was still pretty solid in those days. But by this time, you see some things going on that just raise red flags. And that is, it just seems to me, and I speak with a lot of presuppositions because I'm a Reformed Baptist looking at this, I'm not real fond of seminaries that stand so distant from the church where these young men are aspirants to the ministry and they are not under the oversight of a church. You have this Franklin Presbyterian Church that Machen was a member of growing up that had absolutely no say in his ordination. What I see as I study this is it seems that more and more the church really wasn't having a say in calling men to the ministry and examining his elder qualifications according to 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1. It seemed more and more that they were only relying upon a subjective inward call. I feel like I'm called to the ministry. And there really wasn't the oversight that there should have been for these men to even be ordained to the ministry. And I see that there was quite a difference in later Princeton and in the earlier days when you have Archibald Alexander, who was a pastor for 20 years, Samuel Miller, who was a pastor, and Ashbel Green, who was a great pastor. Something happened to Princeton where they lost their moorings from that first generation, from the ideals that they had. In fact, it got to where Benjamin Warfield had said that he was concerned that there was such an emphasis putting upon the intellectual acumen and preparing that for the pastor going into the ministry that they were relying on the seminary itself to prepare men who had no experience ever getting into a pulpit and really didn't have... This is Warfield saying this himself. And he was concerned that the seminary was taking place of the local church. And you do see this in our day. These things have contemporary applications. And I think that there wasn't enough original oversight over Machen, and I think the problem got progressively worse. And I'm not really sure how that's being solved by Westminster, but I think that it's very important if a young man, I'm not saying he shouldn't go to Westminster or not theological seminary in the case of Aaron DeLine, that's a good thing. As long as he has a proper oversight, as long as the church is keeping an eye on this young man to see if he has those qualifications that are requisite to a call of the ministry. And I saw that in my mind, and I studied Princeton theology a lot, I know more Presbyterian history than Baptist simply because those are the type of books that Banner of Truth put out. In my mind, these seminaries started to go downhill as the church was less and less involved in them. And I don't think that that's the original idea that they had. I mean, if you study the Log College under William Tennant and his sons, William Tennant Jr. and Gilbert Tennant and so on, as they prepared men for the ministry, these pastors were very much involved in these men. You couldn't be part of a seminary and just get lost in the crowd. They know where you were. They could look at your credentials. They could look at your life. They could examine your life and so on. And I just see things at Princeton Seminary as they progressed later on in years that these things were being overlooked. In fact, it had gotten to the point where right now there's a big thing about having a PhD degree as a theologian so that you can be accredited or whatever, that your students could get a degree and so on. Maybe that has its place. I'm not saying that it doesn't, but at Princeton what had happened was there was such a focus on this accreditation that instead of looking for people who were adherents to the Westminster Confession, they were going to bring in these doctorates, people who had doctorates in theology, even if they had to come from liberal institutions. And so they were setting the foundation for their own demise. And I think that, you know, that's
so important for us to keep in mind in preparing men for the ministry. Anyway, Machen died at the age of 55. It's unfortunate in a sense because so much of his writings are relevant for our day, and who knows how much more he could have given to the church. But remember, he was a single, so he didn't have a wife to kind of hold him in check when he made his decisions. And one of his decisions was he was in such demand to go from place to place in order to address some of these issues that sometimes, even though his health called for him to settle down, he kept pushing himself, much to the sadness of those who had been involved in the movements that he had led. Machen died in 1937 at the relative young age of 56. Some commentators, notably Stonehouse, point out that Machen's constitution was not always strong and that he was constantly burdened with his responsibilities at the time. What had happened is he had received a call from Bismarck, North Dakota, to come out and do a number of meetings, and so he left the mild temperatures of Philadelphia and 1936, in December of 1936, and it's mild in Philadelphia, it was 20 below in Bismarck, and he developed pleurisy in the exceptionally cold weather there. After Christmas, he was hospitalized for pneumonia and died on January 1st, 1937. Just before his death, he dictated a telegram to longtime friend and colleague John Murray. The content of that telegram reflected deeply his lifelong faith. "I'm so thankful for active obedience of Christ. No hope without it." He is buried in Greenmount Cemetery in Baltimore, Maryland. So I'll make a couple of short applications and we'll be done. In Proverbs 23:23, it says, "Buy the truth and sell it not." Personally, I am very, very fond of the confession of our church, and I see its importance. If providentially God was to take our family out of here, I had to move for health reasons or whatever, the first question I would ask of the church that I became a part is, "Do you hold a confession?" And I bring this up because I've looked at where people exited to when they left Grand Rapids and people that have exited here, and I don't think they're asking that question. I think that a pragmatic question is, this is where my own personal needs will be met. And basically that troubles me because they don't set a really high priority on contending for the things of the faith. And that wrought problems in not only Princeton, but you look at Union Theological Seminary from when William Shedd taught there in the late 1800s. Within one generation, that seminary was completely liberal. There's a church in New York City called the Brick Church. The Brick Church was pastored by Gardner Spring. Gardner Spring was a good man, except for maybe his views on the Civil War, but he wrote a book, The Power of the Pulpit, and a number of other very good books. He was a solid man. Within one generation, that church was liberal. You say that can't happen to this church. Brethren, history shows that liberalism can even take this church down if we don't subscribe to sound doctrine. If we say, well, that's old hat. We want a little bit more contemporary service, even if our doctrinal ideals are sub-level. We're dealing with a devil that is so subtle. There's a lot of this story that I can't tell you within an hour that North brings out in a book of 1,096 pages, but how liberalism captured the Presbyterian Church. And he does it through finances, he does it through doctrine, and so on. Liberalism, the work of the leaven of the Sadducees, I'm saying. I think it is important to stand for sound doctrine. And at least that's my convictions, and I've been troubled by people that have left, that's not that important with them. But the second thing is, which is a balance to this, one thing that you learn about Machen is what battles to fight. Machen fought heresy. It's kind of funny because John Frame was commenting on the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and when the Orthodox Presbyterian Church was formed, and there were no liberals within her midst, the fight basically was over. So because there were no swords to turn on liberals outside, they turned their swords on each other about things that didn't matter. And Machen had a list of things that he thought, these aren't things that we fight over, differences in eschatology, even our understanding of the moral law, and so on. And yet people leave the church over these things. Machen was very careful to realize, this is not the hill I'm going to die on, our differences of opinion about certain things. But when heresy came in, he was the valiant of truth who fought it, and fought it until he died at a young age. So enamored with the truth was he, and so convicted about these things. So brethren, it's not only important to hold to sound doctrine, we must be very, very careful about the battles that we choose. Because we make a person an offender for a word. And we have people that they leave here because they've been a little bit upset about the smallest matters. And one thing that Machel is an example, he said, I'm not going to fight about the things that are in charity we can differ on. And I think that's really a lesson to us. Before I close, does anybody have any more questions? Go ahead, Joe.
You use the term liberalism throughout the talk here. Speaking of liberalism in the church, is there a relation or is there a big difference between liberalism that we term today, which is much more political?
Well, you do want to differentiate between theological liberalism and political liberalism, but I think political liberalism does flow out of Christian liberalism, because if you don't have a standard to examine things by, you're not going to have a backbone on the things that you stand on. And when people, this is the first thing that people reject, that I believe political liberalism rejects as well, and that is the depravity of man. There's an interesting story about somebody who went to a conference in which Robert Schuller was there, and he says, I'm really not comfortable with the things that you're teaching. You know, he says, I'm a Calvinist. And Robert Schuller says, I'm a Calvinist. I studied the Institutes. I probably know the Institutes more than my professor. And the guy says, it's not coming out in your teaching. And he says, well, the one thing I reject is the depravity of man. And you throw that out and the other things will follow. But here I'm specifically talking about theological liberalism, and I went back to this screen because the things that they were attacking was the inerrancy of the scriptures, the virgin birth, the doctrine of a substitutionary atonement, and so on. This didn't start here. I mean, this started way back with Albert Barnes, even Timothy Dwight. It's interesting in Presbyterian history, a lot of this was started by the immediate successors of Jonathan Edwards, and I think in spite of him, not because of him, but the first two things that were questioned were the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity, and then they had a view of the atonement, not that Jesus Christ was a substitute. There were actually maybe 14 other things that there was a difference of that led the church to split in 1837. In 1869, the Civil War had just ended, and the Presbyterian Church united again, the United Presbyterian Church. But they did not unite doctrinally. They said, we got this common cause now. They united because they said we have a common cause that we have to fight for. But because doctrine wasn't really addressed, I think the real downfall of the Presbyterian Church, the liberal side of it, started in 1869. Anybody else have a question? Okay, go ahead, Brian.
You mentioned the Presbyterian Church in America, not being allowed to use that name, but there is such a thing today that they didn't talk about later. Was that a later split, or how did that come about? The Presbyterian Church in America, PCA Church?
That there was a split in the PCA?
Well, you said earlier that they weren't allowed to use that name, but there is such a church today. So
a Presbyterian Church of America?
Yeah.
Well, the Presbyterian Church of America, and I'm not really sure about these names, maybe the PCUSA. The actual name is Presbyterian Church of the United States of America?
Well, right now...
There's two. Okay. Yeah. Brian, I can't answer that right now because I try to keep track with the more solid Presbyterian churches and ignore the ones that are kind of going off the beaten track. Somebody had a question over here, Pastor Vanette.
I just think this is very useful, Tom, because... I think we have a tendency to think that it just can't happen. to look at that and go, what? You mean in 1924, that's where we were? You know, you just can't imagine. You think of 1924, I mean, you think of that it just wasn't the same then, that somehow it was different then and now.
You brought up an interesting point. There were a lot of things going on at this time. In 1925 was the Scopes Monkey Trial. That's the slang name they gave it. But because of this trial, one of the persons for that was bringing about the prosecution, William Jennings Bryan, was actually a Presbyterian. And Machen had warned him not to get involved in this. But the prosecution initially won and it was overturned on a technicality, but in the press, the fundamentalists were set so far back because public opinion was turning against them. And, you know, we really started going downhill as far as our education about that time. I mean, now it's a rare thing if somebody would teach the Bible in a public school. There, in Tennessee, in those days, you weren't allowed to teach anything other than creation. But public sentiment all along outside of the church was also working against what were called the fundamentalists. Machen never liked to call himself a fundamentalist. He seemed to be termed the head of the fundamentalists. He thought himself as an adherent of the Reformed theology and didn't like the term fundamentalism. But you do have two things going on here. There's a liberalism that's coming in to the church, and then there's also the political liberalism outside that also rejected the Bible as well. And so all of these battles were going on about this time. But, you know, our pastor is so right. You think this could not happen to the Reformed Baptist churches and so on. If we don't uphold these things, it can happen within one generation. We have a lot of young people in our churches that basically, they might not even like this service, you know, they're tired of the Trinity. I've heard it. They're tired of the Trinity hymnal. They want something a little bit more contemporary and so on. Well, we can differ. We can have some differences of opinion on that. But I really want to get to the root of the issue and say, what is your understanding about the innate depravity of man? What do you think about the holiness of God? What do you think about a new birth that can only come from above, where if God does not mercifully interpose, a man will perish? What do you think about the doctrine of men being dead in trespasses and sins? And if we don't guard those, if we don't put a wall up and guard those truths in one generation, any Reformed Baptist church can fall. And with that, I'd better close. Father, we know that these things are rearing their head in our day, maybe under a different name, maybe under the emergent church, maybe under postmodernism. But the battle is the same, and we still have the same sword. You've given it to us. Help us to use it, not to put it into the heart of our brethren over things that don't matter, but to wield it against an enemy who wants to oppose sound doctrine. Father, may we be charitable, harmless as doves, but wise as serpents in these things. May we always have the demeanor of the lamb-like, dove-like Jesus Christ, but at the same time be a valiant for truth as J. Gresham Machen was. Help us. We need enlightenment and we need wisdom in order to do this battle aright. But we have to be united, and we pray that love would hold us together in a love for your truth and for your Son. We ask in His name. Amen.